A Hacker's Paradise, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. The Defense Department wanted to know how vulnerable some of our weapons are to cyber attacks, so they had hackers try to break into the system. Well,
the testers were able to take over these systems completely just by guessing passwords. In one case, it was as simple as guessing a password in 9 seconds.
The bottom line?
They found that an entire generation of Pentagon weapons seems to have been developed without cybersecurity in mind.
Experts hope the test will be a wake-up call.
These $1.66 trillion worth of American weapons are worth nothing if they can be shut down because of a bad password.
Whoa, that's our top story today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Imagine massive sabotage of our country's defenses by people hacking into them. It's a sci-fi scenario, but it may not be that far from reality. That, at least, is the warning coming this week from a new report from the Government Accountability Office. It found that the country's next-generation weapon systems could be easy targets for cyber attacks. That made some experts in the field think about the TV show Battlestar Galactica. In it, an enemy civilization has taken out humanity's entire fleet of fighter jets by infecting their computers. The GAO report found real-life vulnerabilities in U.S. defense systems. Emily Dreyfus has been covering this for Wired. Emily, what are the weapons systems at the center of this report?
Very good and unanswerable question, actually. This report is written... It is an unclassified report, but these weapon systems are themselves classified. So nowhere in this report are the weapon systems themselves named. We can deduce that these are everything from jet fighters to anti-missile interceptors and every kind of weapon system that the Pentagon is developing.
Wow. So what kind of vulnerabilities did the report find?
All sorts of vulnerabilities. The scariest thing, I think, is that they found that basically an entire generation of Pentagon weapons seems to have been developed without cybersecurity in mind, which means that these aren't necessarily vulnerabilities that are only for high-level hackers to take advantage of. These aren't like really hard to get into systems. Some of these things were just that they found default passwords hadn't been changed on the software of these systems. So the testers were able to take over these systems completely just by guessing passwords. In one case, it was as simple as guessing a password in 9 seconds. In many cases, the DoD weapons developers did not notice that the testers were in their system acting like hackers. And they even didn't notice when the testers were trying to be intentionally noisy to make themselves visible so that they would be found. Even then, they weren't found.
Now, to be clear, these are weapon systems that are already deployed, or are they things that are being developed and are going to be deployed? What kind of time period are we talking about?
So we are talking about systems that are being developed. The reason why this report was done by the Government Accountability Office was that the Senate Armed Forces Committee asked them to look into the weapons that the DoD wants to spend $1.66 trillion to roll out and bring to scale so that they can use them. So it is likely that some of these weapon systems are already in use, but they are going to be rolled out further. But many of these are things that are being developed and are not yet being used.
Now, this sounds like one big giant mess. I mean, how can this kind of stuff happen?
I think because there is still a real disconnect in understanding how important cybersecurity is, especially even with physical weapons. The GAO's report noted that test officials said that many within the DoD did not believe cybersecurity even applied to weapons systems. So there has not been an awakening yet, is what this report is saying. You know, all the experts I spoke to about this report said, hey, this report needs to be a wake-up call. These $1.66 trillion worth of American weapons that are intended to keep us safe and protect us are worth nothing if they can be shut down because of a bad password. You know, as our weapon systems have modernized, they are also just becoming computers. Most modern guns and jet fighters are no longer just planes and guns. Now they're actually a computer that flies or a computer that shoots. And that's what makes them so much easier to hack and puts them at so much more risk.
So what's been the response from the Pentagon?
To my knowledge, they have not made a public response.
What about Congress? I mean, isn't somebody saying, hey, before we commit all this money, this has to be fixed?
Yes. Well, nothing that I have seen has happened yet out of Congress, but this GAO report was produced at the behest of the Senate Armed Forces Committee. So they are on it, and they will presumably be reading this report and find it very interesting before they agree to give the DOD the money that the DOD wants to develop these weapons.
This problem clearly goes back at least to the Obama administration. How come this didn't get attention earlier?
I don't think this is a partisan issue. It's an issue of the government not just the U.S. government, governments around the world not necessarily recognizing how big a deal cybersecurity really is. You know, governments have been operating on sort of a Cold War paradigm for a really long time when it comes to military investment. You know, we want to create a very expensive weapon, or if our enemies create a very expensive weapon, then we need to create equally expensive defending technology. That whole paradigm falls down in the face of cybersecurity because it's so much more asymmetrical. You can take down an entire government's worth of weapons with, you know, just a few people at their computer. And I think that government-wide, it's taken a long time for our priorities to realize the risk of that and the importance of that.
Emily Dreyfus is with Wired Magazine. Thanks, Emily.
Thank you.
In Indonesia, thousands of people are still missing 2 weeks after a devastating earthquake and tsunami hit Sulawesi Island. At least 2,000 people died and many more were displaced. And getting water, food, and medical supplies to affected areas is still a big challenge. So what the Indonesian government announced this week may come as a surprise. It said that only Indonesian aid workers can help out in the hardest hit areas. Foreign aid workers have to get approval from the government first and work with local groups. That policy has people like Yeni Suryani worried. She's with the Jakarta office of Catholic Relief Services.
I feel like my hands are tight. I tied up because agency like CRS, we have limited number of staff because, you know, sometimes the program in the country is quite big, sometimes, you know, quite small. So the support from international staff really accelerate, speed up our capacity to respond.
We're going to take a step back now and check in with Jonathan Katz. He was an AP reporter in 2010 when a huge earthquake hit Haiti. He later wrote a book subtitled How the World Came to Save Haiti and Left Behind a Disaster. We wanted to get his take on the response to the current crisis in Indonesia. To get us started, Jonathan, why would Indonesia not want the services of foreign aid workers at a time like this? It seems counterintuitive.
Yeah, I mean, if you follow foreign aid a lot, it actually makes a lot more sense. There has been a lot of talk about the need to have countries lead their own recovery and try to cut down on basically foreigners coming in and invading and taking over everything themselves. The Indonesian government is kind of doing what people have been hoping that national governments would do. But of course, it sometimes shakes out a little differently on the ground when your group is the one who's being told to stand down.
Yeah, I mean, we were talking to someone from Catholic Relief Services, and her concern and others is that it's great to have a nation do it itself. But particularly in these early days when you're trying to rescue people, you're trying to give immediate support. Aren't you missing an opportunity to have people with the right skills in quickly to help?
Some of these things actually don't work the way that people who are sitting outside of the disaster zone imagine that they might. Search and rescue is actually a really good example. Haiti's, of course, the example I know best because I lived through it. That's a disaster where between 100,000 and 316,000 people were killed. there were something on the order of about 3 million people who were in the disaster zone. And the highest number that I was ever able to find for the number of Haitians who were rescued by those international rescuers was 211. And a lot of the estimates are lower than that. The vast majority of people, thousands and thousands of people, were rescued by their friends, their neighbors, other people who were around. And in Indonesia, which is a country that has stronger institutions than Haiti does, it would make sense that Indonesian rescuers would probably be already there and already better positioned to do some of those rescues. So rescue is actually maybe one of the better examples of a place where foreigners are not as useful as they like to imagine.
In what cases are foreigners more useful?
Honestly, the aid system is a mess, and the disaster response system internationally is kind of a disaster itself. Indonesia is a really interesting example. If you had told me, kind of as like a blind item, that there is a country that is trying to crack down on or regulate foreigners after a recent disaster, and you gave me like two guesses, I think Indonesia probably would have been one of the two. The reason for that is because back in 2004, you remember the tsunami that happened the day after
Christmas. Just about to ask you about that because I wondered if the same policy was in place then.
Yeah, I mean, it was a slightly different setup. But what happened then that was really interesting was Indonesia really tried to take over the response itself. Part of what happened was the initial response was a bit chaotic. And so one of the things that the Indonesian government did at the time was they set up a reconstruction and rehabilitation commission. And it really became a model for much of the rest of the world on how a national government can take over an aid effort, force outside NGOs and aid groups to register with them, and direct resources where they need to be, take money in themselves, and govern how that money goes back out. And it certainly wasn't perfect, but it was a widely praised effort.
It's interesting to hear you because when you're sitting in, you know, here, a place like Boston or New York or anywhere in the U.S., and you're hearing about some massive disaster in some faraway country that you don't know a lot about, but you think might be kind of poor, the emotional response is sort of, well, wait. You know, wait, you're not treating your people well, and that's not right. I mean, how do you counter that feeling that somehow the people are being shortchanged?
I know where people are coming from. I feel the same way. But what I learned when I was living through these disasters, and especially the experience in Haiti, is that, to be perfectly honest, it's not about us. And it's much more important that people who actually live in these places, who are the survivors themselves, whose societies and cultures these are taking the lead in their own rescue and their own recovery. And people are kind of scrambling. And part of the scrambling is trying to sort of figure out who's in charge and who has the power. And that's something that people who aren't experienced with disaster might think is kind of crass or beside the point or something that should be dealt with later. But we see in disaster after disaster that you have to deal with it right at the very beginning.
My last question is, you know, you wrote a whole book about the whole Haiti experience and the role of foreign aid. What were your biggest takeaways from that experience? What are the lessons learned and to what degree are they being applied now?
I think the biggest thing is that I think there was a sense from a lot of people in the world that Haitians were bystanders in their own disaster. And actually being there and seeing the way that people came together and then ultimately took charge of their own rebuilding and their own reconstruction really showed me the way in which that's completely backwards. The best thing that foreigners can do is assist people in their own efforts and then kind of get out of the way. And I think one of the most important things that we can do is respect that and try to help without making our own savior complex the big story.
Jonathan Katz is the author of The Big Truck That Went By, How the World Came to Save Haiti and Left Behind a Disaster. He's currently a fellow at the New America Foundation. Thanks a lot, Jonathan.
Thank you.
This is The World. I'm Carol Hills with The World. That new trade agreement that the U.S., Mexico, and Canada recently agreed on, well, it covers a wide range of issues. But if you listen to President Trump, you might think it all boiled down to one thing. Dairy products from Canada.
They've treated our farmers in Wisconsin and New York State and a lot of other states very badly.
The new trade deal still needs legislative approval, but it would give U.S. dairy farmers more access to Canadian markets. The World's Jason Margolis went to Ontario to hear from farmers there.
Philip Armstrong's family has been farming in Caledon, Ontario, for a very long time.
Our family has been on this piece of land since 1869.
Obviously, dairy farming has evolved a lot since then. It's also made huge leaps since Armstrong graduated college 37 years ago. Today, each of his 380 cows wears a high-tech collar. We watch as 24 cows get milked and a computer measures their output.
The collar that they have on them is ID, but it also measures her eating habit on an individual cow. It measures her rumen, the stomach movements, to make sure that that's going well. It measures her lying down time and measures her activity.
Combine that technology with better breeding and nutrition, and Armstrong says his cows are nearly twice as productive as four decades ago. This might seem great, but it's also created a problem for the world's dairy farmers. They're producing too much milk. So to keep things in check, Canada has a system called supply management.
Each farm has a quota, and that's our share of the Canadian market.
They match supply with consumer demand. As part of its supply management system, Canada also places high tariffs on foreign dairy imports, up to about 300%. That's what's enraged President Trump. Canada does let in some American dairy before tariffs kick in, and as part of the updated NAFTA, Canada would open up a few percentage points more to the Americans.
You go, okay, well, that's not much, but that's growth in income we're giving up that allows us to modernize, to expand. So it's frustrating for us as dairy farmers.
And perplexing. The dairy trade between the U.S. and Canada is a sliver of overall trade between the two nations. And Armstrong is annoyed that President Trump singled out Canadian dairy as the problem.
He was distorting the facts, or maybe didn't understand the facts. I don't know. And so he said we were hurting their dairy farmers. Well, Americans had a $600 million surplus with us, but he got into his head that we were mistreating their farmers.
And many American dairy farmers agree with President Trump and applaud him for standing up for them. They point out that Canada also recently redefined some of its milk products so it could effectively shut out American products. Their pain is real. Thousands of small American dairy farms have shut down in recent years. It's not all because of Canada. Far from it. They've been squeezed out by consolidation, corporate agriculture, global competition, and low prices. People are also consuming less milk.
A lot of milk in the past has been dumped because it couldn't be processed in an inappropriate time or sold at an extreme discount.
Brian Gould is a professor of agribusiness at the University of Wisconsin. While U.S. dairy farmers may be in a bad place, Gould says the U.S. shouldn't be telling Canada how to manage its agriculture.
We have no right to do that. I really think we're on thin ice when we demand that they get rid of their quota system.
Gould says, think of the reverse. Canada telling the U.S. to dismantle its production system. The U.S. government sets a minimum price for milk and provides some subsidies. The U.S. also has its own high tariffs on certain dairy products.
Sour cream, for instance, I don't have the numbers exactly. It's like
Graham Lloyd, the CEO of the Dairy Farmers of Ontario, couldn't put his finger on the exact amount. The U.S. sour cream tariff is 187%. And Lloyd says there are a lot of other U.S. dairy tariffs.
On other cheeses than that, you have like 50% tariffs.
Lloyd says this whole milk spat with Canada, it's just politics.
Wisconsin being a significant and important state to the Republicans, namely, obviously, Speaker Ryan, and it was a state that carried Trump, became a political lightning rod. And that is what started the whole process.
Back on the farm, Philip Armstrong says the new NAFTA agreement doesn't address the fundamental problem. American farmers are producing too much milk. And Armstrong believes opening a little bit more of Canada won't make a dent in that.
You know, I feel for the dairy farmer in the United States. I mean, it's got to hurt. But what happened is going to hurt us here, but it has no impact on their, you know, on their well-being at all.
Again, plenty of Wisconsin and New York farmers see things differently. They're glad to have more access to Canadian markets. Still, there's an ironic twist here. Many American dairy farmers and organizations are actually now looking into a supply management system of their own, similar to Canada's. For The World, Jason Margolis, Caledon, Ontario.
This week, we've been obsessed with what could be a murder story. The victim, a Saudi journalist. On October 2nd, Jamal Khashoggi entered the Saudi Arabian consulate in Istanbul and has not been seen since. We're not the only ones obsessed.
Inside Saudi Arabia and outside, I think we're all trying to figure out what has happened to him.
Safad Al-Ahmad is a Saudi journalist and filmmaker who made a documentary critical of Saudi Arabia. She also knew Jamal Khashoggi. Like him, she lives outside the Saudi kingdom because, she says, speaking up can get you in trouble with the authorities there.
Dissidents, human rights activists, even just simple critics of what's going on in Saudi Arabia for the past few years have been put in prison, taken from different countries and brought back into Saudi Arabia. And so Jamal is the highest profile of something that's been going inside Saudi Arabia for more than a year now, I would say. And that's the scary thing.
Safa, tell us again what happened to you after you produced that documentary.
So the government officially accused me of supporting terrorism. And so this shows a lack of understanding of the Saudi government itself, of what is independent journalism, because there isn't anything called independent journalism in Saudi Arabia. And so, like, for a lot of people, even when I was being interviewed about the film, they were like, would you like to be identified? Are you a Saudi dissident? I was like, no, I'm a journalist who's covering your story. But because there is no such platforms inside Saudi Arabia where you can say these things, we all become dissidents inadvertently, and there is no other space. And this is the problem with how the Saudi government is dealing with everyone right now. They are shutting down even the mildest of comments and critique about their policies. And so they've left no room for us. They've left no room for us to be able to properly cover stories. And then they love criticizing journalists for not understanding what's going on in Saudi Arabia. And so it's a lose-lose situation for us.
Has the government clamped down harder since Mohammed bin Salman came,
absolutely,
became the power broker?
Absolutely. On everyone. This is what I mean. Like before, you could be a human rights activist on, for example, women driving or being critical of economic reform in Saudi Arabia, and there wouldn't be as much backlash as now. We thought, like a lot of the activists that have been arrested before the ban was lifted, that they would be released by now. But instead of being released, a lot more pressure has been put on them, and they're accusing them of espionage. It's insane.
Safa Al-Ahmad is a Saudi journalist and filmmaker. We've been speaking to her from Washington. Thank you, Safa.
Thank you, Carol.
Coming up, an American pastor goes free in Turkey, but only after being found guilty of terrorism. You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. Coming up on The World, who should get into Harvard? The oldest, richest American college is being sued for alleged discrimination against Asian Americans.
Harvard is systematically saying that Asian candidates are not likable.
But Harvard says its efforts to create a diverse environment are legal. That story ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. An American evangelical pastor walked free from a courthouse in Turkey today. Andrew Brunson was found guilty of charges including terrorism and was sentenced to more than 3 years in prison. But he was released in lieu of time served and for good behavior. The case had been a huge strain on relations between Turkey and the U.S. Journalist Fariba Nawa is in Istanbul. Fariba, who is Andrew Brunson?
Andrew Brunson is an evangelical missionary who's lived here for 2 decades, and he was living in a coastal city called Izmir and very active in the refugee community as well as the Kurdish community.
And he was found guilty and sentenced, but what were his alleged crimes?
The alleged crimes were aiding and abetting a terrorist group, converting PKK members who are seen as terrorists here in Turkey and by the United States, which allows them to seek asylum as Christians who are being persecuted. These were some of the accusations against him.
So those were the accusations, but what had he actually done? What did he literally do that brought these charges?
Well, it seems like there were messages that the Turkish government intercepted that sided with the opposition. He was meeting with members, American military members at Incirlik Air Base in Turkey. And it seemed to the Turks, this seemed somewhat suspicious, but he was a valued member of the American community here. And he was a good bargaining chip.
And of course, this all happened after the attempted coup. So there was an atmosphere of a real crackdown. Isn't that right?
Yes, yes. There are hundreds of thousands who were arrested after the coup. There was a purge, and he was part of that purge. The coup happened in July 2016, and he was arrested in October 2016.
So why was he released now?
Well, I think the release would have happened a couple of months ago, and there were negotiations in place that fell through between President Trump and President Erdogan. They were discussing several other kinks between Turkey and the United States, and that included Halk Bank investigation, a Turkish bank that was accused of violating sanctions against Iran. And in that investigation, Turkey was asking for a few more things. They were negotiating like they do in the Middle East. There was haggling involved. And President Trump lost his patience and said, no, we're not going to give you any more, and you have to release Brunson now. And this sort of made Erdogan feel humiliated. At this point, he said, no, we are not going to release Brunson. It was tit for tat. You're going to respect our judicial process, which this was the trial that came to be. But there were negotiations still ongoing, from what I understand. And most everyone here in the diplomatic circle was expecting a release.
I understand that Washington accuses Ankara of holding roughly 20 Turkish Americans and three Turkish employees of the American consular mission in Turkey. Any movement on their cases?
No, because they're Turkish. I think Pastor Brunson had backing in the U.S. by the evangelical lobby, which is a very important constituency of Vice President Mike Pence and President Trump. That's why he became the main sticking point or the most important prisoner, American prisoner held in Turkey. There's also a NASA engineer, a Turkish-American named Serkan Golge, and he hasn't gotten half of the attention that Andrew Brunson did, and he's still in prison.
I understand, actually, that Secretary of State Mike Pompeo belongs to the same denomination of the Evangelical Presbyterian Church that Brunson does.
That's true.
Now, what happens to U.S. sanctions? They were announced in August to try to force Turkey to release Brunson. Are they now going to be lifted?
Well, that's what's expected at this point. The sanctions were imposed because he was not being released. In fact, he was put under house arrest. So the Turks did make, you know, one concession. They took him from a prison, put them under house arrest in August. And now the expectation is that the sanctions will be lifted. The Turkish lira will stabilize to a degree. What I'm seeing on Twitter from Turkish reaction is that they're excited that their economy will get better. And this was a good move by the Turkish president to release Brunson.
Turkey has been his home for the past 23 years. Is he going to stay or move back to the U.S.?
He's on his way, from what I understand, to Germany and then the United States. He's being essentially deported as soon as he was freed. And that's the protocol for most foreigners who are arrested. They may spend some time in prison. Eventually, they are deported and not allowed to return again.
Journalist Fariba Nawa in Istanbul. Thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot, Carol.
A NASA astronaut and a Russian cosmonaut are safely back on the ground after being forced to make a dramatic emergency landing yesterday. The Russian Soyuz rocket carrying them experienced an unknown failure during launch. Nick Hague and Alexei Ovchinin landed safely in Kazakhstan less than an hour later. The cause of the aborted launch is being looked into, and there are concerns about how the incident may affect operations on the International Space Station. Lauren Grush is a reporter for The Verge. She covers space. Lauren, walk us through what happened yesterday after the Soyuz rocket launch.
So everything started off completely normal. They took off from the Baikonur Cosmodrome in Kazakhstan at 4:40 a.m. Eastern time. And then about 2.5 minutes into flight, we got indication that something had gone wrong with the booster. And if you were watching the live stream, you could see that they were jerking about kind of violently and there was some kind of breakup in flight. And that initiated the emergency abort sequence, and the capsule that they were riding on performed what's known as a ballistic reentry, and that's when you come in at a much steeper angle when you land on Earth. So I think they experienced nearly 7 Gs, which is 7 times Earth's gravity. So a pretty intense flight, but they landed safely, and they were able to be reunited with their families, and ultimately it was a good and happy ending.
So how high were they when they had to start their landing?
I believe they were about 30 miles up, so they weren't quite in space yet, but they were almost there. The astronauts noted that they experienced a moment of weightlessness, which you're not supposed to be feeling at that part of the flight, and I think that had to do with the fact that they were no longer connected with the booster. And then at that point, they start spinning in the ballistic reentry, and then their parachutes deployed to slow them down so that they could land safely.
They're not spinning as they're racing to the Earth, are they?
Yeah, they are.
Oh, my God.
I've done what is known as a parabolic flight. That's when you feel weightlessness for moments of time. And during the parabolas, you experience extra Gs, and it feels like something is pressing down on you like a mattress. I didn't experience nearly the level that they did, but just imagine kind of feeling like you're pressed up against something. You feel so much heavier. That's what they were feeling, and it can be pretty intense.
Are there any new details about what might have caused this problem?
I don't know if they've traced the exact origin, but I believe something happened during the stage separation. So when rockets launch, pieces of hardware shed away to save on weight. And the Soyuz has 4 main boosters around the center core, and they were supposed to break away. But Russia thinks that maybe there was some contact between one of the boosters and the center core when really they're supposed to separate completely. This was the 65th flight of this particular Soyuz rocket. So it's been around for decades. I don't know if they know what caused that contact, but I think that's the leading theory at the moment.
Now, the U.S. and Russia, they're frequently at odds, especially these days when it comes to geopolitics, but they cooperate frequently when it comes to space flight. Why is that?
NASA has been kind of the shining beacon of hope in our relations with Russia. And I think it's just because when it comes to space, we cannot let geopolitics enter. Now, it definitely creeps into other aspects. When Russia invaded Ukraine, that kind of sparked a debate about whether or not the military should use Russian rocket technology to launch satellites into space. So it has had an impact on other parts of our space infrastructure. But when it comes to NASA, we just can't let those things get in the way. We need them at the moment because the Soyuz is the only way to get humans to the International Space Station. So we have to continue cooperating, and hopefully NASA and Russia will let geopolitics get in the way of that.
Is this a significant setback for the International Space Station?
I would say it's definitely concerning about the station's future. We currently have 3 astronauts in orbit on the station, and they're going to have to come home eventually. They got up there in a Soyuz as well, and the Soyuz capsules can't last forever in orbit. They have a 200 orbital day lifetime, and we're about 130 days into that. So they're slated to come down in December. They could probably stretch that to January, but not very long. So either they're going to have to come down soon, or Russia could possibly launch an empty Soyuz capsule and send that up to the station and give them an extra 200 days to stay on board. But that hasn't been determined yet. We don't know if that's actually going to happen. It just depends on what the investigation finds.
Lauren Grush is senior science reporter for The Verge. Thanks, Lauren.
Thanks for having me.
This next story is also about Russia, but guess what? It has nothing to do with Vladimir Putin. This story is about a young Russian woman. She's an artist, and she draws and tells stories about ordinary Russians. Victoria Lomasko's interest is in people on the margins, living lives that are rarely celebrated in the media. Her new book is called simply Other Russias. Reporter Charles Maines recently visited with her.
To begin to understand Victoria Lomasko, look no further than that packed suitcase still on the floor of her Moscow apartment. For Lomasko spends most of her time out on the road these days, capturing stories most never see. In fact, that idea is at the core of her new book, Other Russias. That's right, Russias. It's plural. And she says that's with good reason.
Ведь речь идет как бы о многих разных Россиях.
It was important to me these last years to make a portrait of the unofficial face of the country. That part we almost never hear from in the media.
Lomasco's black ink renderings center on the angry and the ignored, people in places teeming with stymied dreams and stunted talent, stories of incarcerated youth who can't imagine a future on the outside, Central Asian migrants trapped in modern-day slave conditions in the capital, and forgotten village life, where locals are as unconcerned about events in Moscow as Moscow is about them.
I'm interested in how society is built in Russia, because there are many parts of Russian society that exist separate from one another.
Lomasco says her subjects lend themselves to the sketchpad, not the camera, in part because they don't see themselves as subjects worthy of attention at all.
When I showed them my drawings, they said they were boring. Who would be interested in this? They don't see themselves as heroes.
Lomasco was an early chronicler of the Russian punk feminist collective Pussy Riot, capturing the tragic comedy of the group's 2012 trial for protesting Vladimir Putin's rule that catapulted them to prison and fame. But it's less visible women who feature most prominently in Lomasco's drawings. And while Lomasco is an avowed feminist, disempowerment is also a theme. Take her own hometown of Serpukhov, a small city just an hour's drive from Moscow, where traditional values still reign. There, Lomasco makes no secret of her alienation from childhood friends who can't understand her ambitions for a career as an artist and more.
Russia is a traditional patriarchal country compared to Europe or America. Here, everybody expects a woman to have a husband and a child, and any other achievements don't matter. But I always had this feeling that I had a voice, that I wasn't just an illustrator.
Now, Lomasco calls her work graphic reportage, as opposed to what most in the West would call it, namely comics journalism. For she insists her work borrows less from the frame-by-frame narratives of the comics journalism genre and instead pays homage to home-drawn Russian acts of witness. Think Soviet gulag prison drawings or soldier sketches from Russian wars and revolutions past.
I don't do classical journalism. And maybe I miss some important facts or some big global events. But I see events in a different way. Not the big picture, but up close, face to face. Who was next to me in the crowd? Were they scared or not? How did they feel?
The drawings in Other Russia show how her quest took her to the streets of Moscow in 2011, and tens of thousands protested flawed elections. And afterwards, inside the courtroom, to witness show trials that squelched the uprising and landed dozens with lengthy prison sentences. But hope for something better never quite dies in Lomasco's world. She also turns her attention to other Russians, just beginning to awake politically, like families in the suburbs of Moscow fighting to protect a favorite park from city developers, or a budding movement of blue-collar truckers against excessive taxes that benefit Kremlin-connected oligarchs.
These park defenders and these truckers, they changed their opinions completely and their lives. I would like to see Russia be more like them. People who believed what they saw on TV. And then, one moment, suddenly realized it was all a spell and decided to change everything.
So what's Lomasco doing now?
Well, she's been traveling around other former Soviet republics, interviewing and drawing people who are in these countries that gained independence following the breakup of the Soviet Union. Now, in part, with an eye towards what they're doing better than Russia and, of course, where they're also falling short. And she's, of course, sketching all of this, not only for books, but also installations and murals. And in fact, she has a show that just went up in London last week.
That's Charles Maines in Moscow. Charles, thanks so much.
Thank you, Carol.
You have to take a look at Lomasco's drawings. They're beautiful and blunt, and they really give you a feel for these other Russians. We've got them at theworld.org. Climate change is a fact of life these days, but the changes so far are most dramatic in the Arctic, and that's mostly bad news for all of us. This fall, we're teaming up with the podcast Threshold to take an in-depth look at life in the Arctic as the region undergoes a big melt. Our series starts on Monday, and my colleague Marco Werman recently got a preview from Threshold's host and creator, Amy Martin.
I think one of the key things to understand about the Arctic is that it is not only a place that is being affected by climate change, but it's actually a place that has a lot to do with keeping our climate stable. There are these three different kinds of frozen things in the Arctic. There's permafrost, which is frozen soil. There's sea ice. And then there's the Greenland ice sheet. And all three of those things have a whole lot to do with keeping the planet cool. One of the primary things that all of this ice does in the Arctic forest is that it reflects a ton of heat and light back out of the climate system. And so you can just picture it. If you have a giant white thing and that white thing gets smaller and smaller, that means that there's less heat that can get reflected back out of the atmosphere. Mm. And that means that accelerates warming even more. This is true for almost all the different frozen parts of the Arctic, is that as we change them, it makes it harder for them to do their job of helping to keep us cool. So yeah, I think that's something that we're really trying to get across in this series of stories, is that no matter where you live on the planet, the Arctic affects you.
So we're going to hear a lot about ice and why what happens to it is so important. But the stories we're going to hear from you, Amy, it's more than just ice, right?
Yeah, 4 million people live in the Arctic, and they have a front row seat to all of these changes. I really wanted to try to understand what climate change looks like in the Arctic through the eyes of the people who live there. And after spending all this time in the 8 different Arctic countries, I really had my eyes opened to the way that climate change intersects with all kinds of other issues up there. For instance, I spoke with Carolina Behe. She's with the Inuit Circumpolar Council in Alaska. She was one of many people I talked to who had information that kind of surprised me. I asked her a question that I kind of thought I knew the answer to, and I was wrong.
What would you define as some of the biggest threats to people in the Arctic right now?
Colonization.
Colonization. I was not expecting that.
Yeah, this is something that was a surprise to me too, but I heard over and over throughout the Arctic. There are a lot of indigenous cultures, and almost all of them have gone through some sort of colonization process. One of the groups that I spend a lot of time with are the Sami. These are the indigenous people of northern Scandinavia and western Russia. And I spoke to one woman named Charlotta Savoni.
I am a Sami, and my country is Sapmi, but it is colonized. It is divided into 4 countries, Norway, Sweden, Finland, and Russia. So we are kind of stateless.
So if climate change and colonization, the legacy of it anyway, are two big challenges for people in the Arctic right now, what do they want from the rest of us who have been colonizers and have caused the climate crisis to begin with?
I think that what most people that I spoke with in the Arctic want is they just want to be included in the conversation about what's going on in the Arctic. I think some of the legacy of colonization means that some of the people that are most impacted by these changes, you know, really have to fight to get a seat at the table in terms of all of the different conversations happening around how to respond to climate change. And I think that just listening and taking perspectives seriously of people who live in the North is a great starting point.
Amy Martin of the Threshold podcast, talking with the world's Marco Werman. Amy's series kicks off next Monday on The World. Finally today, race and fairness. Deep conflicts over how to deal with that challenge are as old as the U.S. itself. And next week, they enter a new chapter with a court case against the country's oldest and wealthiest university. Harvard is being sued for alleged discrimination against Asian American applicants. The case has already divided a lot of minority groups on campus. And as Kirk Carapeza from our partners here at WGBH reports, 40 years of legal precedent may be at stake.
The group Students for Fair Admissions is suing Harvard, charging the university holds Asian American applicants to higher standards, ranking them lower on intangibles like courage, kindness, and leadership. Lee Chang is an attorney for the Asian American Legal Foundation, which is supporting the lawsuit. Chang is Chinese American and a Harvard graduate.
Harvard is systematically saying that Asian candidates are not likable and don't have good personalities by orders of magnitude, again, less than candidates of any other ethnic group, which is really nothing but racist. It perpetuates and feeds and creates stereotypes.
Negative stereotypes that Asian Americans just do well in math and standardized tests. Students for Fair Admissions says none of the anonymous Asian American plaintiffs who claim they were unfairly denied admission to Harvard will testify. Still, Chang thinks the group has a chance to win its case.
The people who were harmed, who are the basis for this group to file this lawsuit, are concerned that they will be discriminated against in graduate school admissions, as well as in, you know, job applications. And their existence is real. If they weren't real, this lawsuit couldn't move forward.
Civil rights activists and college leaders see the lawsuit as an attack on race-conscious admissions, which in a series of decisions since 1978, the Supreme Court has allowed, if carefully done. Harvard denies the charges, saying Asian Americans now account for 23% of all admitted students. At a higher ed event in Detroit last month, Harvard's new president, Larry Bacow, defended the university's race-conscious admissions process.
Nobody wants to be judged on their numbers alone.
A WGBH news poll finds a vast majority of Americans, 72%, disagree with the consideration of race in admissions. At the same time, 86% say they value racial and ethnic diversity on campus.
People understand and recognize that we learn from our differences, that creating a diverse learning environment enriches the learning experience for every student on campus.
There's a lot of attention on test scores and race and the Asian American lawsuit, but shouldn't the focus be on legacy admissions, which historically has benefited wealthy white students?
The legacy pool is now an exceedingly diverse pool.
These institutions over the years have been bastions of the privilege.
That's attorney Ted Shaw. He directs the Center for Civil Rights at the University of North Carolina's law school. In the past, Shaw says plaintiffs have gone after public institutions like the University of Texas and the University of Michigan. He sees the lawsuit against Harvard as an attempt to broaden that attack to private selective colleges.
This is a very important moment because the balance of the court is in play. And so we can't assume that the results that have obtained in the prior cases are going to continue.
Justice Anthony Kennedy was the key swing vote in the 2016 Texas decision that preserved race-conscious admissions. Recently appointed Justice Brett Kavanaugh replaced him. Judge Allison Burroughs, who was nominated by President Obama, will preside over the trial here in Boston. Testimony is expected to last 2 to 3 weeks, and legal experts predict the case will reach the Supreme Court. For The World, Kirk Carapeza, Boston.
Our theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. See you next week.
PRI, Public Radio International.